From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, I'm Al Ledson, and you're listening to Reveal.
We've had too many accidents. We've had too many funerals.
The U.S. Coast Guard is known for daring search and rescue missions, helping people when they get in trouble.
It was very tough to hear that Ronnie's death was 100% preventable.
So why are routine missions turning deadly? Plus, arsenic is something straight out of the Middle Ages, but scientists today are sounding a new alarm.
Based on the new cancer data on lung and bladder cancer, arsenic is about 17 times more potent a carcinogen than we thought.
You'd think new science would alert the government, maybe change regulations about how much arsenic should be in our food and water. Think again.
I guess I would say, based on what you've shown me, welcome to politics.
All that's coming up on Reveal. First, this news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. On the evening of Tuesday, October 28th, 2008, the 44-foot sailboat, the Freefall, got into big trouble. They're 100 miles offshore when a wicked storm begins to pound the vessel. The crew, Kevin Hogan, Tracy Garvey, and Phil Rubright, try to secure the boat in the cold, rainy night, and afterwards move below, hoping to ride the storm out. As they sat in the cabin, the storm raged in the dark night. A rogue wave that Kevin estimates to be at least 70 feet slammed into the Freefall, rolled it in the angry sea. The mast snapped, the cabin filled with 6 feet of water, and all hell broke loose. When bad things happen at sea, the U.S. Coast Guard responds.
It was a dark, dark night, and we found a vessel that had two people on board, a broken mast. They were seasick, willing to give up.
After three unsuccessful rescue attempts and one fatality, Lieutenant Lance Leone, newly minted helicopter commander, got the call. It was approaching 5 in the morning, still pitch dark. Winds hit 50 miles an hour, 40 to 50 foot waves. Leone maneuvered his helicopter into a hover just off the Freefall. He and his crew managed to pluck the two survivors out of the ocean.
And I realized at that moment, by being a Coast Guard aviator and flying these missions, at times we were actually answering people's prayers. We were being utilized to save as many people as we could.
And that is what the Coast Guard does every day. But there's always more to the story. And that's what we do on this program. Reveal is a new show featuring the world's best investigative reporting. And today, have we got a show for you. Later in this hour, how a congressman delayed years of research on arsenic at the expense of public health.
They came back with their draft and they said, based on the new cancer data on lung and bladder cancer, arsenic is about 17 times more potent a carcinogen than we thought. 17 times higher.
We'll have information about the state of Missouri making secret cash payments for a deadly drug.
And we discovered that Missouri's director of adult institutions, David Dormeyer, was taking a little more than $11,000 each month to this pharmacy, all of that in cash.
And how for-profit colleges are raking in billions of your tax dollars at the expense of our veterans.
Are you looking at whether or not the instruction is good?
No, that's not a part of the visit at all.
The University of Phoenix has been put on notice by its accrediting agency. Do you look at that?
No, that's a different process completely.
So get ready. Let's pull back the curtain. As you just heard, the United States Coast Guard does some amazing and dangerous work. But they're also the branch of the military that everybody forgets about. Even the president. Here he is in 2010 addressing the troops at Bagram Air Base.
I think we've got every service here tonight. We've got Army. We've got Navy. We've got Air Force. I think we may have a few Marines around too. Now here in Afghanistan, you are all Coast Guard. Is that what I heard?
The mission of the Coast Guard has changed dramatically over the past decade. Historically, its duty to protect our nation's maritime interests has meant mostly search and rescue operations. But since September 11th, the service has taken on an increasing list of specialized security missions. The training of airborne marksmen to disable boats from the sky. Armed escorts of ferries loaded with tourists and commuters. Protecting political conventions and sporting events that could be terrorist targets. Even training to intercept aircraft that might pose a threat to Washington, D.C. And in this time of increasing missions, the Coast Guard has entered a period of increased accidents, injuries, and deaths. Amid questions of unsafe practices, poor oversight from leaders, and a failure to respond to red flags. You just heard about Lance Leone's first rescue mission as a helicopter pilot. 2 years later, the tables turned, and he was the one getting rescued.
We took off that day. It was a beautiful day for the Oregon and Washington coast.
At the time, Leone was based out of Sitka, Alaska. He'd come down to the lower 48 to swap out an old helicopter for a new one. About an hour into the return trip, the crew saw a small Coast Guard boat leaving a harbor near La Push, Washington. The pilot, Sean Kruger, took them down for a flyby.
We overflew the small boat, and at that point, my right hand went waving out the window as the guys below us waved. And then moments later, as I stared, our aircraft blew apart.
The right side of the Jayhawk helicopter had snagged on improperly marked power lines. Power lines that the Coast Guard owned and had been warned about. The tail section immediately separated. The front part of the cabin shot out over the open ocean.
I was being shaken and thrown around. My head was like a ping pong ball banging off of different parts of the aircraft. It felt like a long, long time. And then all motion stopped. I was in the aircraft, upside down, pinned against the bottom of the ocean.
Leone broke free of the wreckage, swam to the surface, and looked frantically for his crewmates.
I struggled to turn, kicking, screaming for Sean, Brett, and Adam. I was struggling to breathe. I looked at the water around me, and it was red. It was silent. All I could hear was waves crashing. My right leg started getting cold. Someone was going to have to get me. I needed to be rescued.
Leone was a sole survivor. That crash in 2010 came in the middle of a 13-year period of accidents affecting Coast Guard aviators, sailors, and civilians.
Covering major news across San Diego.
The official findings from federal investigators show the Coast Guard was going too fast when it crashed into a boat killing 8-year-old Anthony DeWeese during the Parade of Lights on San Diego Bay in 09.
Breaking news off the coast of Alabama right now. A Coast Guard helicopter has crashed during a training mission in Mobile Bay.
Five crew members aboard a downed Coast Guard helicopter are safe today after a crash in the Rocky Mountains. Near Salt Lake City.
Using internal Coast Guard records, reporters at the Center for Investigative Reporting examined accident rates, property damage, injuries, and deaths in the Coast Guard since 2000. Here's what they found. 27 Coast Guard aviators and other personnel died in between 2000 and 2013 as a result of accidents in air, on land, and at sea. They found lapses in judgment and command and missed opportunities to protect crew members and civilians. Take the crash that Leone survived. The wires that ripped apart his helicopter, they were owned by the Coast Guard. A former Coast Guard employee had reported to Coast Guard officials that the wires were poorly marked. The Coast Guard's own internal review found a 1,700-foot gap in the markers. The FAA recommends markers every 200 feet. The Coast Guard has refused to install safety equipment to protect helicopters, wire cutters, specifically designed to prevent accidents just like this. Every other branch of the military uses that safety equipment. That crash was one of a string of accidents between 2008 and 2010. It was the worst period for Coast Guard aviators for over 30 years.
In memory of the crew of Coast Guard 6535, Lieutenant Commander Dale Taylor, Lieutenant J.G. Thomas Cameron, Chief Fernando George, AET-3 Andrew Knight,
Captain Tom Main is a commanding officer of the Coast Guard's Aviation Training Center in Mobile, Alabama. This is him reading a plaque honoring fallen Coast Guard members.
Coast Guard heroes, forever remembered, semper paratus.
In 2012, during a training mission, a helicopter crashed into the bay here, killing all four on board.
My first reaction was disbelief, as you might imagine. And one of the most important responsibilities at that point, obviously, is notifying the families of those involved. But disbelief, and then obviously overwhelming sadness that was tempered by the fact that we had a job to do at that point.
As I said, since September 11th, the Coast Guard has greatly increased the scope of its missions. And Maine says that increase may have overloaded the Coast Guard's ability to maintain proficiency in all tasks, as Coast Guard members have had to compete for finite training resources.
As we added those capabilities after September 11th, and I think we'll all admit there was a tension because we now were asking some air stations, some air crews, some pilots to be good at two very different things.
The result? A decrease in fleet-wide ability. The rash of accidents was something that the then Commandant of the Coast Guard, Robert Papp, acknowledged in a speech in 2011.
We've had too many accidents. We've had too many funerals. 14 aviators lost in 2 years. We've also had several boat accidents, and this is unprecedented. It's unacceptable, and we've got to do something about it.
Shortly before his retirement in May, Admiral Papp sat in his office in the new Department of Homeland Security headquarters. His time as Commandant has been marked by an insistence on increasing proficiency.
Proficiency is becoming a master of what you do.
4 years ago, Papp initiated the Aviation Safety Assessment Action Plan, a service-wide look at why so many accidents were happening.
What I found out is after we did the study, the tempo was so tough and demanding that we were suffering the accidents during more benign situations. In other words, when you send a Coast Guardsman out and he's doing an actual mission, they're completely on. They're focused. But because we were doing so much at such a rapid pace that they were getting a little complacent when it was an easy operation.
In other words, the accidents that have plagued the Coast Guard have not occurred during dangerous operations, but in times of calm. The training exercise in Mobile, 4 aviators dead. Lance Leone delivering a helicopter up the West Coast, 3 aviators dead. During a 2009 boat parade in San Diego, a Coast Guard boat collided with a civilian craft, an 8-year-old boy dead. The Center for Investigative Reporting also analyzed records for property damage and found approximately $375 million worth since 2000. That's significant for a service whose annual budget comes in just at $10 billion. Now, Coast Guard officials say one reason for the uptick is that the culture of reporting has improved. But in the case of that 2009 San Diego crash, federal investigators faulted the lack of effective oversight both locally and nationally.
Hey, how are you? Jonathan?
Yes.
What's going on? Nice to meet you, sir.
Ronald Gill Sr. and his son Jonathan sit at the kitchen table at Ronald's home in Cranston, Rhode Island. A room in the back of the house is dedicated to his son Ronnie and his Coast Guard career.
9/11 is the reason that Ronnie first wanted to join the Coast Guard.
The Gill family is incredibly close.
We talked every day. Every day, not every other day or every couple of days. We always talked.
Ronnie was killed while performing a ferry escort March 25th, 2007, on Puget Sound near Seattle.
They were deployed down there periodically, and Ronnie had been down there multiple times. He had done this escort hundreds of times. And the day that he died, he was not supposed to even be on that boat. But somebody didn't want to go, and Ronnie said, I'll take your shift, you know, because I talked to him at 12 o'clock. He said, I'm getting ready. I'm going to go on the boat. I'll be back in a couple of hours. I'll call you when I get back. And it just wasn't, you know, just didn't expect that to be my last conversation with him, ever. You know, he never expected that. Just like I know that that night, Jonathan went to the movies, and my wife and I went to bed, and at 11 o'clock, he came busting through the door. Mom, Dad. Something happened to Ronnie. The chaplain, and as we found out later, Lieutenant Aldeanzi were at our front door, and we jumped out of bed, and they came in and told us. And my wife told him, no, go away, you have the wrong house.
On patrol, Ronnie was the gunner up front. Without warning, the boat's driver executed a high-speed 180-degree turn. Ronnie shot from his position and hit the water. The boat's propeller struck his head. An assembly of top Coast Guard brass came to Gill's home to deliver the results of an internal investigation.
I can remember sitting at this table that following year. Captain Doug Wisniewski sat where you are right now in tears reading this report. It was very tough to hear that Ronnie's death was 100% preventable.
Later, in Washington, the Coast Guard showed Gill new safety equipment being deployed fleet-wide. They showed him safety straps and helmets with built-in radios so gunners like Ronnie could talk to the boat driver. But a later audit showed big problems. Those radios often failed. An inspector general estimated a reliable replacement wouldn't be ready until 2020.
Ron Gill's death was another seminal event for me.
Just weeks before his May 30th retirement, Commandant Robert Papp acknowledged the Coast Guard's poor safety record and reasons for it.
It may sound like excuses, you know, rapid growth, inexperienced people, new equipment, and a lot of pressure on us to field that equipment as quickly as possible. We were deficient as a service in terms of preparing those young people to go out there. I'm not proud of that. The only thing I am proud of is that we have not let Ron Gill's death go in vain.
10 days after Papp's retirement, the Center for Investigative Reporting received a new set of accident data from the Coast Guard. It shows overall incidents were up in 2013. That story was reported by G.W. Schultz from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Ben Adair produced it, and it was edited by Bob Saladay. Coming up next on Reveal, there's trouble in our drinking water.
Well, if they've already got some proof that it's 17 times more potent, you'd think they'd want to get the information they had out.
How one lawmaker put years of scientific research on hold with a single paragraph. Stay with us. There's more to the story on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, I'm Al Letson, and you're listening to Reveal. So, picture this. Renee Thompson just had a baby, moved into a new house in Ortonville, Michigan. The future is full of possibilities. And then everything started to fall apart.
I became very ill. My children and my husband, we all became very ill after we moved into the house. My son, who was 6 at the time, he started to have severe chest pains. My older daughter had headaches. My husband had GI bleeding. I became very fatigued, a lot of headaches, skin problems.
She went to doctor after doctor. No one could tell her what was happening to her and her family. After seeing 13 doctors, she finally got some answers.
My physician, he checked me for heavy metals. I had symptoms similar to what he had seen years prior, where he actually had a patient who was being poisoned purposely with arsenic. And when the results came back, he called me and said I had high levels of arsenic.
Arsenic. Renee got poisoned from the water she was drinking. Her new home pulled it from a private well. Now, Renee's an outlier. Most of us will never come in contact with as much arsenic as she did. In fact, arsenic is naturally occurring. We all have a little arsenic in our system. It comes from the ground. It can be found in food and water. It's also in weed killers and pollutants from mining and power plants. Renee moved to a new town where the arsenic levels in the water are also high. She has a filter on her water system, but many of her neighbors don't. They don't think they need them.
You know, everybody's been drinking this water for years, and of course, if somebody died, maybe the arsenic had something to do with it. You don't really know, but I'll take my chances.
That's Jim Carroll. He's the president of Metamora Water Service. He's been in the well drilling business 35 years.
There's actually old farmers that drink that their whole life, and they're still fine.
So if arsenic's in our food, in our water, a little bit here, a little bit there, no big deal, right? But new science has brought into question how much arsenic is actually safe. David Heath with the Center for Public Integrity has our story.
It's early summer in the wooded countryside of central Maine. It's warm enough for a woman to be outside playing with her grandchildren in a kiddie pool.
My name is Wendy Brennan. I live in Mount Vernon, and I live with my two daughters. And I also live with my two grandchildren, who are Madeline and Abigail. And they are 3 and 19 months.
Brennan and her husband moved here 15 years ago. Now, she helps raise her grandchildren and works as a health aide.
You try to get a place like this for your kids, and I'm glad they're here. But the water's a huge problem in this town. And I'm not sure who knows about it. If probably not a lot of people.
Brennan walks to the back of her house and turns on a spigot. The water looks perfectly clean.
No, there's nothing to indicate there's anything wrong with it. I mean, it even tastes good. That's the thing.
But Brennan got a shock when she signed up for a study that offered free water quality tests. Researchers from Columbia University found that her water contained high levels of arsenic, more than 5 times the federal standard.
Your job as a mother is to give your kids all the best, and just by giving my kids juice, mixing up frozen juice, or giving them cups of water, which you're supposed to do, I was actually giving them a sediment that's settling in their body, and I may not know for 10 years if it's affected them.
Brennan got another shock in April. That's when the Columbia researchers released their study. They found children who drank water containing arsenic, even water that met federal standards, scored 6 points lower on IQ tests than kids who drank water virtually free of the toxin.
The magnitude of the impact on child intelligence is comparable to that we and many others have observed with low-level environmental lead exposure.
That's Joseph Graziano. He's a professor of public health at Columbia University, and he headed the peer-reviewed study. Graziano has devoted much of his career to researching lead, a toxin so dangerous to children that it was removed from paint and gasoline decades ago. He says lead affects the brain and kidney, but arsenic is far more damaging.
The arsenic effects just sweep across the body and impact sort of everything that's going on. And so if you are exposed to arsenic, for example, in drinking water, you are at an elevated risk for a whole set of adverse health outcomes, some of which are of major public health concern in the United States.
For many years, the Environmental Protection Agency has known that arsenic causes a variety of cancers. But its last official review of the research on arsenic was in 1988. And since then, studies have linked the toxin to heart disease, strokes, and diabetes. In 2003, EPA scientists began a new review, examining hundreds of studies. 5 years later, they prepared a report that found that arsenic was far more dangerous than they previously thought. The EPA wouldn't discuss its findings, so I asked Michael Hansen. He's a scientist with Consumers Union and an expert on arsenic. He monitors developments at the EPA.
They came back with their draft, and they said, based on the new cancer data on lung and bladder cancer, arsenic is about 17 times more potent a carcinogen than we thought. 17 times higher.
So what does that mean? Based on the new science, some people who drink water containing arsenic throughout their life, even water that meets current federal standards, could get cancer from it. Women are especially vulnerable. The EPA scientists made this calculation. If 100,000 women drank water containing the legal limit of arsenic every day, 730 of them would get lung or bladder cancer. By 2011, a panel of independent scientists had reviewed the EPA's report. The agency's findings were about to become official. Once that happened, the EPA could consider tightening drinking water standards. But that's not what happened.
Good morning and welcome to the third meeting of...
This is from a 2011 hearing of the Congressional Subcommittee that oversees funding for the EPA. Republicans on the committee blasted the EPA.
Too much, too fast could be the mantra for the EPA, whether we're talking about spending or regulations.
The lawmakers voted to slash the EPA's budget, but that's only part of the story. Behind the scenes, something happened that stopped the EPA from issuing its findings on arsenic. All it took was one member of Congress and one paragraph. The lawmaker inserted the paragraph not into a bill, but into a committee report attached to a bill. That one paragraph essentially ordered the EPA to halt its evaluation of arsenic and turn the work over to the National Academy of Sciences. It also instructed the agency not to take any actions based on its scientific findings.
Arsenic is about 17 times more potent a carcinogen than we thought.
Lawmakers use committee reports to get something they want without having to put it up for a vote. Federal agencies aren't required to follow the report's instructions, but they usually do in order to protect their funding.
I guess I would say, based on what you've shown me, welcome to politics.
Congresswoman Shelley Pingree of Maine is a Democrat who sits on the subcommittee that oversees funding for the EPA. She also represents the district where Wendy Brennan lives. We asked Pingree, who put the paragraph into the committee report? She had no idea.
Major policy changes like this can happen somewhat in the dark of the night with very little information to the public.
So who's responsible for delaying the EPA from releasing its findings? I asked Steve Ellis. He's the vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. He's also an expert on Washington backroom deals. Ellis says it all comes down to the powerful House Appropriations Committee.
It's not something that the rank and file are engaged in. If you're not on the Appropriations Committee, you're on the outside. And, you know, you don't even know where the room is, much less you don't have access to the room.
The Appropriations Committee controls how the government spends its money. And Ellis says only a high-ranking member of that committee could have put the paragraph into the report. Our investigation pointed to Congressman Mike Simpson. He's a Republican from Idaho and was chairman of the subcommittee that oversaw the EPA's funding. We found that Simpson received thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from a lobbyist for two pesticide companies. Those firms sell weed killers that contain arsenic. Here's what happened. In 2009, the EPA reached an agreement with the pesticide companies to ban nearly all uses of the weed killer. But that agreement was conditioned on the EPA completing its scientific review of arsenic. In 2011, the paragraph in the committee report put the EPA on notice and delayed its official review. So the ban never happened, and the weed killers are still on the market. We wanted to talk to Simpson. We reached out to his office, we emailed, we called for weeks, but no one responded. So we went to Capitol Hill to find him. We're in the Rayburn Building, which is one of the office buildings for the House of Representatives. And we're told that members of Congress typically don't just walk in the front door of these hearings. They go through the back door, and we're trying to find the entrance to that back door. Congressman Simpson, my name is David Heath. I'm doing a story on public radio about arsenic. At first, Simpson said he didn't recall the language. But then he nodded and took credit for the paragraph in the committee report.
I'm worried about drinking water and small communities trying to meet standards that they can't meet.
Well, the EPA has been evaluating arsenic now for over 10 years. And so because of this now, this is delays it for another 5 years.
We have no idea how they come up with their decisions.
Well, did the pesticides companies lobby you for this language? Did you know that one of their lobbyists has contributed $7,000 to your campaign?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But I've got a hearing.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your time.
Okay.
I appreciate it. We tracked down the lobbyist hired by the pesticide companies, Charlie Grizzle. He told us a different story.
I was part of a group that met with the congressman and his staff a number of years ago on our concerns.
Documents show Grizzle began donating to Simpson's campaign a few months before the congressman put that paragraph in the report. Since then, Grizzle has donated thousands more to Simpson's campaign.
I don't see a connection. I've been a friend and supporter of Congressman Simpson's for a long time.
Two of Grizzle's clients are Luxembourg Pamel and Drexel Chemical, companies that sell weed killers containing arsenic.
Arsenic has a bad reputation.
That's Michelle Eldon, an executive at Luxembourg Pamel. Her company has aggressively argued that the EPA's findings on the danger of arsenic are wrong.
There shouldn't be a concern in the U.S. from the low levels that are existing here.
We wanted to talk to the EPA, but they declined all of our requests. So we turned to Charles Fox, a former assistant administrator at the agency. Fox says there are legitimate concerns about how environmental regulations impact businesses and local communities. But these delaying tactics are often designed to benefit industry.
It's not appropriate to delay these scientific questions indefinitely. Fundamentally, we have an obligation to protect public health and the environment, and that decision needs to be made on the best science that you have today.
And this is bigger than arsenic. That same committee report ordered the EPA to redo every toxic chemical evaluation currently underway, 47 in all.
Okay, so this is very low process.
Back at her home in Mount Vernon, Maine, Wendy Brennan shows me a filter that removes arsenic from our water.
It cost $800 to have the filtration system put in.
Brennan still worries about all the arsenic-tainted water she and her family drank for so many years. She's also worried that her neighbors don't know that they may be at risk. I told her that Congress had delayed the EPA from releasing its findings on arsenic.
Well, if they've already got some proof that it's 17 times more potent, you'd think they'd want to get the information they had out and then continue to explore.
For Reveal, I'm David Heath from the Center for Public Integrity.
Michael Montgomery and Mia Zucker-Candle produced that story. It was edited by Jim Morris, Suzanne Reber, and Ben Adair. Additional reporting from Rebecca Williams at Michigan Radio. If you want to see if you live near an arsenic hotspot, go to our website, revealradio.org. There's a map there with the latest available data on arsenic in water. I've also asked David Heath to join me in the studio with a quick follow-up. David, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So what can people do to reduce their exposure to arsenic?
People might be surprised to know this, but almost everybody is exposed to arsenic. They get it in the food that they eat and the water that they drink. And it's also in beer and wine and fruit juices. So what you need to do is, first of all, just check your water. And you can do that if you're on city water. You can go to the website of your water company and take a look at what the arsenic levels are. They're required by law to post that. If you have a private well, you really need to have it tested to see if there's arsenic in it. And there's parts of the country like Maine or Michigan and other places where there's very high levels of arsenic in the water. So you really need to check. And then the other thing you can do is there's been a lot of talk about arsenic in rice and other foods. It's in beer and wine and apple juice. Consumers Union actually has done some analysis of this, and they have their recommendations on their website. You should go check that out, too.
What does the EPA make of all this?
The EPA, of course, wouldn't talk to us, as we mentioned in the piece, but they've actually talked quite a bit about political interference with science. In fact, President Obama himself campaigned on that issue, and in 2009 he signed an executive order to try to prevent interference with government scientists. The EPA came in and they had very ambitious plans about doing a lot more assessments of toxic chemicals. Before you can have a regulation, you have to know how toxic a chemical is. And that process was, they were barely producing any assessments under either the Clinton administration or the Bush administration. So they had these very ambitious plans to do a lot more of these. And what they're finding is that there's a lot of political interference.
Do you see any way for them to get around that political interference? Or is this kind of par for course? This is what we have to deal with.
That's a really good question. I think in this case, the EPA did have the option of just ignoring Congress. They had that option. But the fear is that if you ignore Congress, the committees that are funding your agency, if you ignore them, that they're going to get retribution. They're going to take it out on you. So that's why they do it. So I don't know what the answer is for this kind of thing.
David Heath from the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
If you really like that story, you should check out our podcast. We go in depth, and all summer long, we are going to be bringing you the best investigative reporting there is. So check it out. Go to iTunes or your favorite podcasting app and just type in Reveal. It's going to be a great summer, and we need you to be a part of it. So check us out. Next up, what for-profit schools don't want to tell veterans or the government.
And do you feel like this almost $1 billion of taxpayer money to the University of Phoenix is a good investment for the taxpayers?
When we return in a minute with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, I'm Al Letson, and you're listening to Reveal. You've probably heard about the botched execution by lethal injection that happened a few months back. That incident shined light on what's normally a pretty hush-hush business. How exactly states are getting the drugs, training the staff, and making sure lethal injection executions are happening as they're supposed to. Turns out, nothing here is as it seems. Several states are shrouding the most serious punishment in secrecy. Missouri is one of them. Reporters from St. Louis Public Radio spent months trying to identify where the state is getting its lethal injection drug. And they succeeded for a while. Reporter Chris McDaniel is here to explain. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Al.
So paint a picture for me. What happens when you attend an execution?
Well, you do a lot of waiting. At the execution I attended in February, we waited around for most of the day. The press corps was waiting in what's normally the break room for the corrections officers at the state prison in Bon Terre, Missouri. And at one point, a man with a headset walked over to us and just said quietly that it's done. About 10 minutes later, the director of the Department of Corrections, George Lombardi, walks in. He was wearing a black raincoat and a scarf, a sign that he didn't mean to stay for very long. He walked up to the podium.
Director?
Thank you.
And read a prepared statement.
Our thoughts and prayers tonight are with Bob and Janelle Harrison.
And then Lombardi left without taking questions from the press.
Thank you.
Then the spokesperson for the Department of Corrections takes the podium. His name is Mike O'Connell. He gives a breakdown of some of what took place that day, the condemned man's last visitors, his last meal, but he doesn't answer the substantive questions. I asked where the state got its drug.
Yeah, the execution proceeded as the protocol calls.
I asked how we know if the drug is effective.
As I said, it was carried out in accordance with the protocol.
I asked if O'Connell was going to answer any of my questions.
As I said, it was carried out in accordance with the protocol.
So, Chris, why the secrecy? I mean, I think something as important as capital punishment, everybody wants to be transparent and open, right?
I think in order to understand the secrecy, you have to understand that the vast majority of those in the medical profession would not be willing to participate in this. And those that are willing to participate in executions definitely don't want the world to know that they are participating. So Missouri has gone to some pretty extraordinary lengths to hide its suppliers. It's paying pharmacies in cash. And we got a hold of documents which showed which pharmacy it was. It was a Tulsa pharmacy called the Apothecary Shop. And we discovered that Missouri's Director of Adult Institutions, David Dormeyer, was taking a little more than $11,000 each month to this pharmacy, all of that in cash.
Wait. He's carrying $11,000 in cash, going to pick up these drugs that are going to put somebody to death, and it's completely off the books.
It's off the books. And to make matters somewhat more egregious, this pharmacy that they were trying to keep a secret, it wasn't licensed to sell in Missouri. Selling drugs in Missouri without a license is a felony punishable by up to 7 years in prison.
So why does it matter where the state got its drugs if the inmate is going to be executed anyway?
Well, this is putting someone to death. This is really the biggest power that a government has. And the reason that states are able to carry it out is because it's in the name of the public. It's those states saying, the public wants this person put to death. And so our goal is to make sure that the public is aware of everything in that process and what they're a part of. And as far as the drug, the quality does matter. If the drug isn't potent and pure, the inmate could suffer during the execution. Other states have recently had some pretty grisly executions that have lasted for 20 or 40 minutes. And those have raised questions about if it violates the constitutional ban against cruel and unusual punishment.
So what happened after you identified the pharmacy?
Well, then a death row inmate sued the pharmacy, which agreed not to provide the drug for his execution. And then the state said it had found another supplier and executed the inmate.
Wow. I'm curious here, because there's no paper trail. If it is a new supplier, like, do we know who that new supplier is?
We really don't know anything. The state has denied most of my public records requests. I mean, since our investigation aired late last year, the state has become much more secretive. Missouri has carried out more executions in the past 6 months than it had in the preceding 7 years, so it's becoming much more relevant.
So this is happening more often and even less information.
Exactly.
So what are you doing to try and get past that? Like, how are you climbing these walls that they keep putting in front of you?
Well, there are a couple of things that we can do. One is, you know, we can report on the secrecy so that the public can become aware of it. And then the other tool that we have is suing them for violating open records law. And that's exactly what we've done. I've sued alongside the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and the ACLU of Missouri. And we think that the public has a right to know how the state is getting and using these drugs, especially since they're carrying out the death penalty in the name of the public, and it's using the public's tax dollars to pay for these drugs. Here's Tony Rothert from the ACLU.
The state of Missouri is basically saying, trust us, even though everything that they've done with respect to the procuring of drugs and carrying out the death penalty in recent months has shown that we can't trust them.
Do you see any signs that the pressure that's been put on the state has got them rethinking their policies?
Yes and no. So in May, our Attorney General, Chris Koster, a Democrat who's previously supported the secrecy, he gave a speech where he said that the state's secrecy should now, quote, concern all of us deeply. Here's Koster explaining his position.
Do I think that the process can be made better? I do. And do I think that transparency, particularly around such a profound act of state government, is important? I do.
But the very next week, his office was back to defending that secrecy in court. So it remains to be seen if it's going to result in any actual change.
Chris McDaniel from St. Louis Public Radio, thank you for joining us. Please, you got to let us know what happens with this lawsuit.
Thanks for having me on, Al. I will.
All right, you can learn more about Chris's investigation on our website, revealradio.org. A lot of Americans have a soft spot in their hearts for the GI Bill.
You said something about an education. What about a man like Sergeant Brown here who's just been let out? You mean he can get any kind of education he wants? Now you're getting the idea. Any kind of education and in any part of the country.
The post-World War II GI Bill was one of the most successful taxpayer-funded programs in U.S. history. It helped build America's middle class. But the post-9/11 GI Bill, well, that's a different story. For-profit schools are making billions of dollars in GI Bill money, but many veterans say that those schools are leaving them with a lot of debt and worthless degrees. No state has a better view of the problem than California, where nearly two of every three GI Bill dollars goes to for-profit schools. So who's looking out for the veterans and the taxpayers? Here's Aaron Glantz with the Center for Investigative Reporting.
The University of Phoenix, San Diego doesn't look like much. It's just a few office buildings and a suburban business park off a freeway exit. I'm here because over the last 5 years, the University of Phoenix system has enrolled 80,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans at a cost to taxpayers of nearly $1 billion. Garland Williams is the school's vice president for military affairs. He gave me a tour.
You know, this one is where an enrollment advisor would talk to a potential student.
The Center for Investigative Reporting found that this single campus of the University of Phoenix has received $95 million from the new GI Bill. That's more than the entire University of California system. It's more than any brick-and-mortar campus in America. Williams says veterans are making a simple calculation.
Well, veterans choose the University of Phoenix, and they choose them for the reasons that the programs we offer are the ones that they desire, and it leads to careers that they want to aspire to.
The University of Phoenix won't say whether veterans who go to school there graduate or find jobs. But here's what we do know. The school's overall graduation rate is under 15%. And when students take out loans, they can't pay them back. More than a quarter of students here default within 3 years of leaving school. That's performance so bad that California banned the school from getting any state financial aid. And it's not just the University of Phoenix. The Center for Investigative Reporting found nearly 300 schools have failed the state's minimum standards for financial aid, but still receive money from the GI Bill. Here's just a few. Massage schools, paralegal programs, and auto repair academies. Even schools with no academic accreditation at all, like the Institute for the Advanced Study of Human Sexuality, got GI Bill money. It all adds up to more than $600 million.
We're not getting the investment that we wanted when we sent these men and women to school.
Kate O'Gorman is political director for Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, which pushed the new GI Bill through Congress in 2008.
And what we wanted when we started the post-9/11 GI Bill and when we fought for it so vigorously was that somebody would be able to come home, get a good quality education, and really be able to set forward where they're going to go next. And instead, what we're seeing is because of some of the bad actors getting an enormous amount of GI Bill dollars, that we're not seeing some of the veterans getting the most benefit out of their GI Bill.
Yeah, 4:30 in the morning and David paces up, packing his lunch for work. He runs electrical cable for a defense contractor at Navy Base San Diego.
When you first start on the stage, they don't have the air conditioning on, so.
When he retired from the Navy in 2009, Pace dreamed of a career in business. He enrolled in a bachelor's program at the University of Phoenix. But after spending an estimated $50,000 of GI Bill money on his degree, Pace says he is still stuck doing blue-collar work, the same work he did in the service.
I think that's the most frustrating part about it, is that I could have just came right out of the Navy and got this job without the time and the headache.
Pace feels he was tricked into attending the University of Phoenix. He says a school recruiter told him he could turn his military experience into academic credit and graduate in just 18 months. Leaving him with enough GI Bill money to pursue a master's degree. But none of that worked out. It took Pace 4 years to get his business degree, and his GI Bill was spent.
When you're in the service, you have all the best information and resources at your fingertips. The same should be true when you're out of the service. So University of Phoenix created...
Getting an associate's degree at the University of Phoenix costs nearly 10 times what a community college would charge. Over the last 3 years, just 40% of the University of Phoenix's revenue has gone to academic instruction. Nearly as much has gone to marketing, recruiting, and profit. Last year, the school was put on notice. Its accrediting body said the University of Phoenix did not, quote, support student learning and effective teaching. I asked Garland Williams, the school's vice president of military affairs, what taxpayers were getting in return for their substantial national investment.
And do you feel like this almost $1 billion of taxpayer money to the University of Phoenix is a good investment for the taxpayers?
The veterans have chosen us because of the programs that we offer. We have over 100 programs that we offer, and they have found the higher education goal that they've sought. And those programs lead to careers that they want to aspire to. So they have chosen us.
Do you have any evidence that it's actually leading to careers for these veterans?
The veterans have chosen us. Yeah, they have chosen to use their entitlement at the University of Phoenix.
Williams says the school is working with the government to ensure that veterans' needs are met. To prove this point, the company allowed me to sit in when a team of auditors from the California Department of Veterans Affairs carried out an inspection at the San Diego campus. LaTanya Johnson is a senior education specialist.
Are you looking at whether or not the instruction is good?
No, that's not a part of the visit at all.
The University of Phoenix has been put on notice by its accrediting agency. Do you look at that?
No, that's not a part of the visit at all.
Or any issues they might be having with the faculty not complying with certain regulations. You look at that?
No, that's a different process completely.
The inspectors never leave the conference room. They have just one goal, to make sure that schools aren't billing the government for students who don't exist. Turns out no one from the state or federal government knows if the education the VA is paying for helps veterans find jobs.
This situation is unacceptable. Unacceptable.
In Washington, lawmakers have tried numerous times to reform the GI Bill. In 2012, Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa issued a 5,000-page report that argued little was being done to safeguard the taxpayers' money.
Neither the Department of Veterans Affairs nor the Department of Defense has any way to assess whether or not they're getting a good education. I might add, neither does the Department of Education, nor does any of the entities that accredit these schools. They have no way of assessing what's happening to these students.
But year after year, their efforts have gone down to defeat. A bill that would have blocked schools with no academic accreditation from receiving GI Bill money failed. Another bill designed to stop for-profit schools from spending GI Bill money on advertising or recruiting failed to get out of committee. Again, Kate Gorman, political director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
The for-profit schools do have a very powerful lobby here in Washington. Almost every time the veterans community goes into an office and says, we need these strong reforms and regulations, we see a for-profit school lobbyist walking out.
Now the legislative fight is moving to the state level.
Mr. Frazier is up next with Assembly Bill 2099.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In California, the University of Phoenix successfully blocked legislation that would have required schools to tell regulators how many veterans graduate and how many find jobs. I asked Garland Williams of the University of Phoenix to explain his company's position.
You don't think that the public, which is paying for these veterans to go to school at your institution, deserves to know how many of these particular students are graduating because we're paying for their education?
What I can tell you is that the support that we provide our veterans, our active duty, and their family members is personal. We take that as a moral right. And I'll tell you that they take this as a personal mission. They do it as a calling. And the reason they do it as a calling is because they want to continue their mission that they did when they were in service.
But we don't deserve to know how many of them are actually succeeding.
You deserve to know that we provide the utmost care to our military. We think we do it right because veterans choose the University of Phoenix.
Rosa, here, $10.
Gracias.
Coffee and donut, man.
David Pace wishes he never made that choice. At 6 a.m., he walks past the food trucks that line the entry to Navy Base San Diego, clears security, and grabs his hard hat. He says other veterans should think carefully before deciding where to spend their education benefits.
Don't go just for the money. Actually go and have a goal set out that you're going to school for, because if it's just to get the money, the class will be over and you don't really get the value out of it.
But is it realistic to expect veterans to police the GI Bill? That's the job of Congress and regulators. 5 years after the new GI Bill became law, there are still virtually no restrictions on where that money can be spent. For Reveal, I'm Aaron Glantz from the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Aaron's piece was produced by Aditya Sambamorty and edited by Amy Pyle. To hear more stories from Reveal, you gotta sign up for our podcast. We have stories appearing there all summer. They're going to blow your mind. We're going to have more on arsenic through the ages. It didn't get its bad rep for nothing. And a story about what happens to small town life when the big industry in town is hazardous waste. To find our podcast, search Reveal on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. You can also get those links at revealradio.org, where there's a whole lot more on the stories you heard today. Reveal's executive producers are Ben Adair and Suzanne Reber. The senior producer is Mia Zuckerkandel. Jim Briggs is our mix engineer, with help in the studio from Allegra Bandy. Support for Reveal comes from WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida, and State of the Reunion. Special thanks for this episode to Michigan Radio and to KUT 90.5 FM in Austin, Texas. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.